On the phone this morning, I have New Zealander Brian Gould, who many of you will know was the deputy leader of the British opposition Labour Party in the conservative Margaret Thatcher era, where he obtained a major insight into the mechanism of the Westminster parliamentary system, its pros and its cons. After leaving politics, he took the post of being the Chancellor of Waikato University, and as a result of his life's experience, he authored a book called The Democracy Sham, where he illuminates the weakness of democracy and the need for humanity to awaken to the fact that we need to inform ourselves of the issues and be participators in this process of self-governance. So kia ora and good morning, Brian.
Kia ora, Tim. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Brian, how did you get to naming your book The Democracy Sham?
Well, it took a bit of agonizing to reach that particular title, but it did encapsulate what I'm really concerned about. And that is something that's become, I guess, clearer to me since I came back to New Zealand, clearer even than it was when I was in British politics. I went into politics in Britain because, like many people, I think, I found myself concerned about the way society worked. I didn't agree with Mrs. Thatcher's famous assertion that there is no such thing as society. My view is society is very, very important. There is an interesting question as to the balance between the rights of individuals and the rights of society, but there's no question in my mind that we owe a great deal to our society, to the fact that we live in society, and we must therefore try to make sure that it works well. And in my view, that also means that it should work to serve the interests of everybody in that society. Now, inevitably, there'll be many people, this is true in every country at every time, certainly true in New Zealand today, who say, well, we're not being looked after as well as we would like to be. And that's always going to happen, because in any society there will be scarce resources, they have to be allocated, and there will be conflicts of interest, and they have to be compromised, and inevitably some people feel disappointed. But nevertheless, my interest in politics was to try to ensure that power and the freedom of choice were spread as widely as possible throughout the society that we lived in. In my view, societies have a natural tendency to lead to a concentration of power. In almost every society, if they're just allowed to run as they would do normally, there will be some people who are stronger or more intelligent or luckier or richer, and they will use that power to increase their advantage over everybody else. In other words, they use the power that they have or that they start with in order to entrench that power and make it count for even more. Now, some people say that's fine, that's the way societies ought to work. We shouldn't be worried that some people do badly and some people do well, because we can't stop that from happening, and if some people do well, then at least there's a chance that society as a whole will benefit. I don't take that view. I think that it's best if societies try to organize themselves so that they counteract those concentrations of power. And one of the ways that we do that is that we try to spread political power. In other words, in a democratic country, we ensure that everybody has a vote and that every vote counts for the same. Now, that is a very powerful weapon that we have to counteract the huge economic power that we see developing in the hands of just a few people. And indeed, in the hands of fewer and fewer people, because the global economy that we're now seeing emerge is increasingly controlled by smaller and smaller but bigger and bigger multinational corporations. And therefore there's a sort of a battle being set up, in my view, between democracy on the one hand and the overwhelming economic power of the major international corporations. And that's really why I entitled the book The Democracy Sham, because my fear is that we Democrats, without really realizing it, we are losing out, and we've lost a lot of the power that we had to control our own affairs and to shape the society that we want to live in. Now, I think this message is, or this danger is more apparent in New Zealand as a small country on the edge of the major world economies. It's more apparent here than it is, say, in Britain or the US, because there people can think that at least they have some control through the big corporations who are mainly found in countries like America or Britain. They have some control over what's happening in the world. I think that's an illusion, mind you. But in New Zealand, it's perfectly clear that we have very little control. And I suppose the starting point for my concerns, and I'm sure some of your listeners this morning will know, will recognize this, if you look at just the headlines of the past few months, you'll find that there are a number of successful New Zealand companies, I'm thinking of iHug or Trade Me or 42 Below, which have done very well, and they get snapped up. They're bought up by overseas companies because they are successful, and the consequence of that is that they move overseas. They're run from headquarters in other countries. That's not true only of very successful companies. If you look at failing companies like Feltex, they, in that case, they're closed down, but they're snapped up in a sort of fire sale by their major Australian rival. If you look at other New Zealand companies that are doing reasonably well, Fisher and Paykel or Air New Zealand, they are carrying on all right, but they do so only at the cost of moving part of their operations overseas. Fisher and Paykel, as we know, is going overseas, or at least in part. Air New Zealand is subcontracting much of its work to overseas contractors, so that jobs are being lost in New Zealand. If you think of Air New Zealand, incidentally, you might remember Ralph Norris, who was the CEO, a very successful CEO of Air New Zealand. He went to a job in the Commonwealth Bank of Australia, so he's gone to Australia. It was reported when he took his job that he would be paid a salary of some millions of dollars. And in the same breath, it was said, without any sense of irony, that his first task would be to lay off or destroy the jobs of 4,000 workers. Nobody seemed to think that that was remarkable. If you look at Australia again, you'll see that Australian media are being bought up, as is Qantas, another airline, by huge private equity consortia usually from overseas, from America and elsewhere. If you look further afield, you'll see many of the major world issues, climate change, as you mentioned, third world debt, the war in Iraq, which is probably energy-based and is to do with oil. All of these headlines represent issues that we in New Zealand feel strongly about, but we feel that we have very little power to control what's going on, or even to influence what's going on. Now, in my view, the reason that we feel concerned but also feel powerless, and the reason that we have very little traction for our concerns, nobody listens to us, is that we are now being painlessly, or at least so it seems, painlessly but seamlessly absorbed into this huge global economy. And by that I don't mean that we should be concerned about free trade. That's not my argument. There may be an argument about free trade to be had, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about international investment. I'm not talking about international technology or communications. What I'm talking about is the global freedom for investors using capital to roam the world without anybody telling them they can't come there or can't go there. And they can roam the world demanding of elected governments, or non-elected governments for that matter, any governments, demanding of those governments the conditions that they choose and that they demand. If they don't get them, they say, right, well, you won't meet our requirements, we'll take our investment somewhere else. And the consequence is that many, many governments, even apparently elected democratic governments, seeming to control their own affairs, in fact, they are powerless in the face of the demands of the major international corporations. Now, how did this happen? Well, 40 or 50 years ago, for those of your listeners who are old enough, as I am, to cast your mind back that far, you would have found a society where if an overseas company wanted to come and operate in New Zealand, sell or manufacture or to invest, they would have to meet the requirements laid down by the New Zealand government. Our elected government representing our interests. And that government could say, well, you've got to meet our health and safety legislation, or you've got to meet our political and human rights legislation, and so on. That is no longer the case. The change took place in about 1980, when Mrs. Thatcher came to power in Britain and Ronald Reagan was the President of the United States. And what they did was hardly noticed by most people. What they did was they removed exchange controls. They freed up capital to move wherever it chose. Now, it's always significant in a way that the language of freedom is very often appropriated by those whose actions are actually threatening freedom. It sounded like a good thing. The dollar floated, the pound floated, and so on. Capital was free to move wherever it wished. We could take our money with us wherever we wanted to go, and so on. So a lot of people said that's great. But what it meant was a huge shift in the balance of power between democracy on the one hand, our elected governments, that is, and the power of those who controlled these huge forces of international capital. Now, when I say huge forces, I mean it. The daily movement in what is called hot money, that is money that just chases the world for short-term advantage, the daily movement represents a sum of money that is more than most countries produce in a year. And it's just such a... The world is awash with this money. It's sloshing around looking for tiny advantages in interest rates, for example. We're foolish enough to be offering them the highest interest rates in the advanced world. So that's what's pushing up our dollar and causing such damage. It's short-term money. It doesn't do us any good. It's not invested with us. It's just parked with us in order to take advantage of those high interest rates. But it's also the case, of course, that money is invested for productive purposes, as we've seen with the purchase of New Zealand companies. And that means that a huge proportion of our economy, indeed higher than in most other advanced countries' economies, a huge proportion of that economy is now owned overseas, and it's going on rising, that proportion. The result of that is that a lot of the profit that is made by companies operating in New Zealand isn't reinvested in New Zealand at all. It's repatriated back to headquarters in New York or Sydney or wherever it might be. And that's a huge burden on our balance of payments. In addition, of course, we're having to pay these very high interest rates in order to attract that hot money to balance our trade, or to balance our accounts, rather. Now, all of this is making life very difficult for us, but it does represent the extent to which we are losing control over our own economy. Now, I'll carry on for the time being, if you like, because I can keep going in this thing quite some time, but intervene if you would wish to. Many people say that this is true, that there is a downside, as I've described, but that nevertheless the advantages outweigh the disadvantages. They would say that the world is more prosperous, that since the global economy came along, everybody's been better off, and that generally speaking we should just swallow hard and accept the downsides because the benefits are there for all to see. Well, if only it were true. But if you actually look at the statistics, you will see that far from boosting world economic development and growth, if you took 1980, as I would suggest, as about the time when the global economy began to take hold, the growth rates before 1980 were much better than they have been since. And such growth as we have had has been extremely haphazard. It's gone up and down like a yo-yo. And some parts of the world have been prosperous for a time and then collapsed. And that's been true of parts of South America and Eastern Europe, and most particularly, of course, in Asia. Many of your listeners will remember the Asian crisis of the late 1990s. Much of the growth is dependent on a very unbalanced and unsustainable structure for the world economy. It all rests on the world's willingness to fund a huge American deficit. And the reason they do that is because the dollar, the US dollar, is regarded as the only safe haven in times of trouble. And so people buy and hold dollars, pushing up the value of the dollar to the extent that the Americans are able to enjoy a living standard that their own productive capacity doesn't at all justify. And they can use overvalued dollars to go around the world buying up everybody else's economy. Now, this can't last. Sooner or later, people will lose confidence in the US dollar as the deficit becomes increasingly unsustainable. And then we're in real danger of falling off the high wire and facing another major international economic crisis. Now, for some people in the global economy, they don't have to wait for a crisis. It's there already. All the statistics show that the supposed wonderful growth of the world economy has benefited mainly rich countries, and that the bottom 20%, the less developed countries, as the UN describes them, they have actually got worse off over the period of the global economy. And indeed, in parts of Africa in particular, but also parts of South America and Asia, the problem of debt and poverty has simply got worse and is now has reached crisis point. So there's nothing in the development of the global economy that would support the argument of those who say, oh, well, globalization is good for us all. When we look at the experience of individual countries like New Zealand or Britain, we see the same thing. One of the things that the multinational investors demand of governments is that governments should hand over the control of the economy to non-elected officials, usually bankers, like our governor of the Reserve Bank, Don Brash, and then Alan Bollard. They make the decisions as to what is happening to our economy. When this was done and the power to make these decisions was handed over, many people thought this was a good idea. You can't trust the politicians, they would say. Well, that's what we used to call democracy. What is the point of having democracy and elected representatives if they no longer take the decisions that for which we can hold them accountable? No one holds Alan Bollard accountable except to the government under the contract he has with them. But he can, even if everybody's screaming with pain, he can still push up interest rates if he so chooses. No one can dispute that or make him think again. He is free to take that decision. Yet he is a completely unelected official. I've got nothing against him personally. But this is the very negation of democracy. And the reason that this is done is because it is undemocratic. The big multinational investors do not want to invest in the country where they fear that politicians will represent the interests of their voters rather than the interests of big business. And that's why they insist on monetarism as the basis for economic policy. The consequence of that is that we have the same lurching progress, such as it is, within individual countries as you see across the globe as a whole. So if you think back over recent years in New Zealand, we've gone up and down, up and down several times, even the last 15 or 20 years. The dollar has soared up and then slumped down. We've been through reasonable periods of growth and then even recession at times for brief periods. And such growth as we have had has been distributed very unfairly. As in other countries that have followed similar policies, in New Zealand, there has been a huge increase in inequality. The rich have done very well. They've had not only big salary increases, they've had tax cuts, they've had bonus share issues, they've had all sorts of perks. They've had great increases in the value of the assets that they hold, whereas the bottom 30 to 50%, if they're lucky, have stood still, but some have gone backwards over that same period. And that is absolutely true of every country that pursues similar policies. We used to be regarded as one of the great centers of equality, of egalitarianism. But as a consequence of these policies, we've become one of the least equal countries in the world. And that's shameful. What the multinationals want, of course, is not just favorable economic policies. They want favorable tax rates. Very interesting that we're getting in the budget cuts for businesses, not for individuals, because there's a sort of a leapfrog competition. Everybody's reducing taxes for businesses in order to attract them, and we're forced to do the same. As soon as we cut business taxes, you can bet your life that next year the Australians will cut them further, and so it goes on. They want very easy rules about health and safety. They want weak trade unions. They want a whole range of policies that suit them and which are not necessarily policies that any one of us would ever vote for. So for all of these reasons, I take the view that the battle is joined between democracy, those people who are the current beneficiaries of very difficult struggles by our forefathers and forebears to try to secure democracy. Once we've got it, we find that it's losing its power, that in fact power has now moved away from democratic governments into the hands of the multinationals. And if you look at an issue like the environment, which will be of increasing concern to many of your listeners, then the issue becomes quite stark. If we pursue the current policy and get absorbed into a global economy, that global economy operates on the basis that the market is always right. That's the whole belief of the people who support the global economy and who are the major operators and beneficiaries of it. And they believe that the dice must lie where they fall, that it's a good thing that the rich should get richer. If the poor get poorer, that's too bad because it's their fault. That would be the general attitude. But what we have to look to is to try to make sure that if the market is a valuable mechanism, which clearly it is, it should be made more valuable by being restrained in various ways. It doesn't always get the right answer, and it doesn't get the right answer on environmental issues. You have to choose. If the market has its way, if it's just free for all in the marketplace, the market is too short-term in its outlook, too narrowly focused on profit for a handful of shareholders to be able to protect the environment. The whole problem of global warming is a great example of market failure. The market cannot deal with these kinds of issues. And yet, for as long as we leave major decisions in the hands of global corporations, our democratic view, or the view that we would wish to enforce democratically, that we need to change, that won't happen, or at least will be very difficult to achieve. So my view is that without realizing it, we have lost a great deal of power, but that we need to regain that, reclaim that power for ourselves at the expense of the big global corporations if we're to make any real impact on issues like world poverty, like climate change, like third world debt, like the energy crisis. All of these things are beyond the reach of market solutions, and they can only be properly addressed if we have fully functioning democracies.
Yeah, this is excellent, Brian. Listeners, we are listening to Brian Gould, who is talking about the democracy sham and how we as a nation and also as a planet need to take stock of the fact that we have to get more information and then take action. So, Brian, yes, it's really important. So where do we go to make this, to get people empowered to be participants in our democracy?
Well, Tim, that is the fundamental question, and it's not an easy question to answer. If there were easy answers, I'm sure we would have found them and applied them by now. There is no magic button that we can push. But that is not to say that there is nothing we can do. I think many people have concluded, as they've been told by people like Mrs. Thatcher, that there is no alternative. Yes, there is an alternative. There are many very well-regarded economists, including Joseph Stiglitz, who won a Nobel Prize for economics and a former deputy governor of the World Bank, George Soros, the arch-capitalist himself, Paul Krugman, who's a very well-known American economist, John Greavesmith, a British economist. Many, many people have written about some of these topics, and there is no shortage of ideas as to how we should improve the situation. What is missing is not the ideas, it's not technically a difficult problem, but what is missing is the political will, and that's where the democratic process comes in. Because we now have to trust democracy, and we have to make sure, as you pointed out yourself a moment ago, we have to make sure that people are informed. Most people are unaware that these major forces are operating in this way. They see the fact that there is, in New Zealand, an election every 3 years, and they say, good, you know, that's democracy. It's working. What are you worried about? But the point is, there's no point in voting governments in if they have no power. And fundamentally, that's where we are at present. We have to ensure that when people go to the polls, that they understand what the issues are and what the challenges are, and that they make sure that they vote for people who have undertaken to them that they will reclaim for this country the power of democratic government. And that's not just true in New Zealand, it's true in other similar countries where we should be making common cause at governmental level, but also at the level of individuals and voluntary organizations to increase awareness of the desperate need to ensure that that multinational corporations do not run our countries. Now, you can do that in all sorts of ways. You can put further restraints on the movement of capital. You can lay down and agree international treaties which would require certain conditions to be met by international investors. You could take technical steps such as to improve the requirements that are made of international investors before they invest. You could ensure that the prudential regulation of international banks is tightened up so that they can't just lend at random and without limit, but have to tailor their lending to the amount that they're prepared to invest in the country, for example. In other words, there are a lot of, you could set up a new bank increase the role of the Bank of International Settlements. You could negotiate a new Bretton Woods agreement that would regulate the free floating of exchange rates and create greater stability. That would certainly be helpful to New Zealand, which is at the moment being crucified on the cross of an overvalued dollar. So there's no shortage of measures that could be taken, and indeed there are international examples of countries that have done this successfully. Perhaps the most successful economy in the world at the moment, and has been for the last 10 or 15 years, is China, growing at about 9 or 10% a year. They are doing that without becoming a fully paid-up member of the global economy. The Chinese currency is not fully tradable in international exchange markets, foreign exchange markets. The Chinese government, I'm not saying we should emulate them in every respect by any means, but the Chinese government exercises very close control at who can invest in China and who can't. Similarly in India, perhaps to a lesser degree, but the Indians themselves have also maintained a very close control over their economy and made sure that international investors don't take it over. And if you remember at the time of the Asian crisis, one of the many countries that was affected was Malaysia. Now, Mahathir Mohamad was the Malaysian Prime Minister at the time, and he outraged international opinion, and particularly the opinion of the leading world investors, by saying that he wasn't prepared to accept the prescriptions of the IMF and the World Bank and deflate the Malaysian economy and destroy it very substantially. He did something very different from what other Asian countries were advised to do and did do. He imposed some exchange controls. He took control of the Malaysian economy himself, or for Malaysia, and the result was that Malaysia came through that Asian crisis with much less damage than any other Asian country. In other words, if you have the courage to do these things, it's amazing how effective they are. In the end, even the international investors will come back to you if they can see that you're running a successful economy. And in the case of New Zealand, a successful economy would be one where we're not burdened with policies that are unsuited to us, where we make decisions in our own interests, where people can have some control over the way the economy works. And I believe in those circumstances, New Zealand would prosper, because we're lucky, we are on the edge of the world's most fastest growing markets in Asia, and particularly China, and there's no reason why we shouldn't be extremely prosperous. We're very efficient producers of primary products and elite premium food products that the rest of the world is desperate to get their hands on. All we need to do is follow sensible policies, and we would do very well indeed. And then international investors would be very keen to come in and have a piece of that.
Yes, because we seem to feel that the parties of, particularly the party in power, have become sort of entrenched and not showing too much vision. We've got a situation at the moment where the government can't even pull a coherent policy together regarding climate change, and they've tried a number of different methods. They didn't actually go to the public either to tell us. And so there's a something going on where people feel disempowered, and then of course you get others say, okay, well let's take a shortcut, let's go for referendums and see if we can find our a way through this by pushing through a binding referendum to jerk the government up, or the parliament up as such.
Yes, well, climate change is a very good instance of the sort of thing I'm talking about. When the government first announced that it had signed the Kyoto Protocol, it was taking the whole issue seriously, it intended to apply the Kyoto Protocol and reduce carbon emissions. When it said all of those things, the idea that it came forward with, in order to achieve at least a part of that, was not very surprising. What they proposed was a carbon tax. But you may or may not remember or have been aware at the time, I don't know whether your listeners will be aware, as soon as that was announced, Comalco, the big aluminium smelters, who are huge consumers of electricity and therefore huge net emitters of carbon into the atmosphere, they announced, they simply said flatly to the government, if you introduce a carbon tax, we will go. We will move our plant from New Zealand, we'll take it somewhere else where we won't be faced with such a thing. And what did the government do? It caved in. And we're still, as you point out, we're still waiting for a convincing substitute for a carbon tax. And the dilemma that the government faces is exactly the dilemma I'm describing. How do they protect New Zealand, our economy, our environment, our people, from all the difficulties of global warming? How do they meet their international obligations under the Kyoto Protocol without upsetting the huge multinational corporations that control our economy? And unfortunately, the answer is, well, they dare not do that. They dare not upset those people, and so they've abandoned their original and perhaps best ideas to how to deal with this. And now we're scrabbling around for something less effective. Now, the problem with, say, a referendum, or the idea of referendums, is that inevitably with a referendum, you put, on the whole, a single question to the voters. And you have to formulate that question, obviously, very, very carefully, to ensure that it doesn't bias the voters to a particular answer that you may or may not want. And the difficulty is that with the sort of issues that I'm talking about, it's very, very difficult to see how you could compress all that into a single question. You could certainly say to the government, or you could say in the referendum, do you agree that the government should stand up to multinational corporations? I would hope that many New Zealanders would say yes, but that wouldn't all that much help the government to do precisely that. In other words, what we need to do before we could even contemplate, I think, taking the referendum route, would be to ensure that the electorate is much better informed than it currently is. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book, because the book does, I think, and I hope in a readable way, set out a lot of these issues and alert people to the fact that if they want to have a functioning democracy, they want to control their own futures, then they need to put it to the politicians that on a whole range of issues, those politicians have got to serve the interests of New Zealand voters, not the interests of big international investors.
Yes, it means that there are many cases. Of course, do we have to do submissions to Parliament? Do we have to go around and get people's signatures on a piece of paper, go to the whole country to get 100,000 or 200,000 signatures to actually force it in front of the government?
Well, yes, all of those things. I mean, I don't think there's any shortcut here, Tim. There are some people who are revolutionaries. They say, well, you just storm the centres of power and take them over by force. Well, I don't believe that that's either possible or desirable. So the only other option is the hard, time-consuming, wearying business of trying to move public opinion. The great virtue of a democracy is that sooner or later, in a properly functioning democracy, the politicians will respond to public opinion. And if public, because otherwise they won't get elected. And the whole sort of pressure of democratic politics is to identify what the public want and move to meet it, to offer them, the voters, what they want. Where we're missing out at the moment is that the voters are not well informed enough to know what they want. They're vaguely dissatisfied. They know that they're losing control over their own lives. They know that more and more of the decisions that matter are not even being taken in New Zealand, but taken elsewhere. They know all that, but they don't know what to do in order to reverse that situation. And that's where it takes hard, patient work. That is writing, speaking, broadcasting. This is one of the reasons I'm speaking to you today, Tim, because in my own very small way, I'm only a single individual, but I'm trying to do my bit to alert people to what some of these issues are. And once people begin to talk and think and discuss these matters, then you're at least on the way. And I'll say this about New Zealand. In my experience of several countries, two in particular that I know very intimately, that is Britain and New Zealand, I think New Zealand has a more advanced public debate on these kinds of issues than any other country I know. That's not saying very much, but it is saying that these issues are at least being discussed in New Zealand, and increasingly discussed. In countries like Britain, hardly at all. But in New Zealand, I mean, just to take one example, the current concern, I think justified concern, about the health of the New Zealand economy, many people can see that we can't go on as we are. We are running a huge current account deficit, so that everything that you and I spend, the living standards that we think we can enjoy, anything up to 10, 12, even 15% of that living standard is currently being funded by short-term hot money from abroad. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to pay our way in the world and balance our accounts. Now, that's a desperate situation for any country to be faced with. And yet, very few people understand that. They see that the government is in surplus. Many people don't distinguish between the government and the country. The government is in surplus because it's taking more from us in taxes than it needs. So it's making a surplus on the deal. But the country is desperately trading at a loss. And the only way we can balance our accounts is by offering very high interest rates to suck in hot money from Japan and the US and elsewhere, speculators who just want to take account of those high interest rates. And they also hope that if they all do the same thing, that will force up the value of the dollar, and they'll then be able to sell dollars at a profit as well. Now, increasingly, people understand that not only can that not happen, go on happening, but if it does go on happening, it just makes the problem worse, because the higher the value of the dollar, the less competitive we are, the less we can sell our produce overseas or even in New Zealand by comparison with imported goods, and therefore the worse our trade account becomes. In other words, we're at present heading at great speed down a no-exit road, and we're going to hit the buffers very shortly. Now, at least, as I say, there is a debate about that in New Zealand. In a country like Britain, where they've had similar experiences from time to time, it's really been almost taboo. You cannot discuss the value of the pound and so on. When I was a Member of Parliament in the British Parliament, I used to table questions about the value of the pound, and the answer would come back, no, you can't have an answer on that question. It's confidential. It's too sensitive. at least there is a lively debate in New Zealand at present about the value of the dollar and the whole stance of monetary policy. Can the governor of the Reserve Bank really go on putting up interest rates to try and clobber the housing market when the real result is that he kills off our productive economy, all those people who make and sell things into international markets? Is that a sensible way of going about it? Why are interest rates no longer working as a counter-inflationary measure? Are there better ways of controlling inflation than using interest rates and the exchange rate? All of these are very real questions, and indeed, as I understand it, although I haven't seen this confirmed yet, the Select Committee in our Parliament on Finance is going to look at precisely these kinds of questions. That's very encouraging to people like me who want to see a debate. We can't be sure that the debate will come up with the right answers. There may not be any right answers, but at least we need to raise that level of awareness to make sure that people understand what are some of the issues that are threatening our democracy.
Yes, Albert Einstein said that we cannot solve a problem with the same consciousness that caused it in the first place. So essentially, for New Zealanders, it's a consciousness-raising experience. We have to actually shift our vision higher and get a greater overview of what we're doing.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Unfortunately, at present, as I said earlier in this discussion, there are all sorts of people who are concerned about, you know, one issue or another, about foreign ownership of New Zealand, about climate change, about the Iraq War, about third world debt. All sorts of people concerned about all of these issues, but very few of them put them all together and have an analysis which explains why they are all problems for us. They tend to focus on just one problem. For example, well-intentioned politicians internationally who've tried to deal with the problems of third world debt in Africa have come forward with issues that are specifically tailored to writing off debt and so on. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't do that. That's a good start. But it's not dealing with the problem, because you can write that debt off, but you're still looking at a country that has no capital, that when it does get some capital, it does so by borrowing at very high interest rates. Very often that capital is borrowed for the purpose of some major piece of infrastructure, a dam or a new highway or so on, which perhaps the economy doesn't really need. They'd be better off having field hospitals and small primary schools, say. But the advantage and the appeal of a huge construction project is that the aid is actually paid to big Western construction firms. They are the ones who benefit. And you then find a poor country struggling to feed its people is lumbered with some huge piece of construction and infrastructure which is going to take them generations to pay off and which does nothing for them. So it's vital that we understand the complexity and the interrelationship of these issues. There's no solution in just picking one out and saying, let's deal with that one. I'm not saying you shouldn't focus on individual issues and that there aren't things you could do to help a bit, but you won't resolve the problems unless you have, as you put it correctly, I think, that overview, that if you step up a bit and look down at the whole scene, that's what we should be doing, so that we understand what's at stake.